All right, welcome back, everybody. Here we are once again talking some more Survivor 42. Dominic, how are you feeling this week?
I'm feeling good. I'm actually excited to be watching and talking about the season, which is not a pair that I've had in a while, but this episode was good in its own right and also better than I had anticipated given the twist that we all correctly feared was looming around the corner based on the previously on segment. And so given the circumstances and then also just given the content of the episode, this was a fun episode to watch and glad to be back in here talking about it.
Yeah, I'm totally on the same page here. This episode in particular I thought was very strong despite having some things that we will be getting to shortly to overcome as far as the format of it all was concerned, and 42 in general continues to very much be doing the trick for me as far as just what I'm looking for in a modern season of Survivor. And actually, before we even get into the Hourglass and what we saw play out with the merge, maybe not a merge, I don't even know if this is technically a merge or not. I did want to say one of the things that I continue to just love about this season, and I did a little digging here to back up what I thought was the case but wasn't entirely sure, is just the sheer balance of the perspectives that we've gotten to see and the characters that we've gotten to hear from and been able to at least relatively consistently track over the course of these first six or seven, heard it both ways, episodes here. Dom, listen to this as far as the confessionals are concerned, just over the course of the season, and I promise we will not spend a ton of time talking about like the edit in general here, but I thought this was amazing and I love it so much. So I wanted to share with you and with the audience out there. Dom, of the 12 people that were present in this episode, we are looking at, when it was all said and done, total confessionals on the season. I'm not going to go through names, but just numbers here. We have 23, 23, 21, 20, 19, 18, 17, 16, 15, 14, 14, 10. And actually, as just kind of an exercise here, Dom, who do you think is tied for the lead for the most confessionals on this season?
I was going to say, I thought that might be fun just to see if my perception of who was getting the most screen time is just wildly off. And I know there's sometimes these edge cases in terms of this gets counted as two confessionals instead of one because of this. But however you slice it, this is music to my ears. This is, I think, has to be the best split or the best distribution of airtime that we've had in any modern season, really. And even going back before that, you know, it was back in the Russell era and then really after that where people started complaining in full force about these uneven edits. And so going back more than half of the show's run, I think this has to stand the test of time at this stage of the season. But let's it feels like it's gotta be Marianne for one of those high counts.
Marianne is not one of the 23s.
Okay, well, that there you go. As if any more proof was needed. Let's see.
For the record, Marianne is the 21, and six of those came in the premiere. So ever since the premiere, she's been basically middle of the pack.
Okay, given that, I want to say Tori?
Tori is 17.
Okay, and I could definitely believe you if you had told me either 23 or 14. You know, it all feels very balanced to me. All right, I'm going to keep at it, going to keep plucking away. Give me... I mean, we've heard so much about Jonathan. I don't know if we've heard a ton from Jonathan, necessarily. So...
On Jonathan?
Oh, Mike.
Mike is one of the 23s.
Okay, there we go. Who's the other?
The other is Hi. And yeah, one of the things that really stood out to me in the... confessional chart that I'm looking at, which incidentally I didn't realize I had a person that I could be crediting here, but it conveniently says down at the bottom of this is via at Just Strategic, JU Strategic, and I would imagine that not every confessional chart is necessarily going to be like an exact match for these figures, but the larger point I think absolutely still stands. And to return to what you brought up initially, Dom, I would be very surprised if this was not the runaway, like most balanced confessional counts through this point in a season, but one of the things that really stood out to me the most is Jonathan is one of the 14s, even though it, or just, yeah, Jonathan and Lydia were both at 14, even though it felt to me like we were seeing a ton from Jonathan pretty much every week, and Lydia was like one of the quieter people in the cast.
And likewise, that count for High surprises me, because my memory of him is as someone who doesn't pop up that often, but when he does, always has something that you want to pay attention to, but he doesn't get much of the throwaway stuff. But maybe there was one episode where he was just more dominant than I gave him credit for, but I love that we get to ask these questions now, and it's, you know, it's not this one person, whether it's, you know, Russell Hantz or Russell Shantz or whatever, this one person has 2.5 times the confessionals of the next highest person, and the only question is, how egregious is that ratio going to be by the time we get to the end of the season?
Right, and for the record, by the way, we had that one week, episode 3, where no one on the blue team got a confessional, and they are, generally speaking, 2 or 3 behind the leaders of the pack here. So if we just like remove that exception, I would guess that this is an even more balanced kind of split than the initially already kind of startling numbers suggest. So just wanted to say that up at the top of the show, since I think we will potentially have some criticism for some of the other production decisions along the way here. I love this so much. And on top of that, I continue to believe that this cast is an absolute home run, as was last season's cast, and the casting in general continues to be, I think, one of the strongest things Survivor now has going for it. So if we can keep this kind of ball rolling, I think, at the risk of jinxing it, it would take some unprecedented, and I do not use that word lightly, kind of producer ineptitude to mess up this formula. If you keep getting such good casts and letting them all get some words in along the way, I continue to be very optimistic about what modern Survivor could be. So, yeah.
I will say that that flatness maybe does extend to the star power of the cast too, in the sense that I think it's harder to pinpoint people who I desperately need to see play Survivor again at this relatively early stage than for some other seasons. And yeah, if we do get to, you know, 45, 46, and Jeff goes back on his word, because, I mean, it's Jeff, he would never do that. But if he did, and we started seeing people from the 40s make their way back, I think some of the others would, like, shine more brightly than the people on 42 so far. But that's fine. I don't need the season to be so lopsided where there is, like, a Shan, or there is someone who the season is built around, and then everyone else just, you know, is fighting over the table scraps in terms of airtime.
I also think another contextual consideration certainly worth mentioning is each of these tribes has gone to roughly the same number of votes during the pre-merge. They all went to at least one. And so that, I'm sure, plays a role in how they're able to present the story versus something like last season, where it was Shan and Ricard going to, I think it was 4 in a row, or something around there in the pre-merge. So they have that kind of advantage this season that they didn't have last season, and frankly in most seasons, as far as making the story more balanced, if they want to go that route, is concerned. So at least willing to factor that into the equation as well. But just generally speaking, this is one of the most refreshing and confidence boosting kind of developments I feel like we could have had for this season. And I agree with you that because no one is super standing out, as which I would consider a very good thing in general, it may be the case that we wind up at the end and there aren't a couple of people that were like clamoring to see back immediately because no one has really stood out above the pack. But I remember saying about 41, as it was relatively early into the season, that I don't even know if I need a new cast for 42. I would watch these same 18 people just run it back and play against each other all over again. And I think I'd be willing to say the same thing about this 42 cast as well. I would have no problem if we showed up for 43 and it was just these same 18 people again.
That's one thing that I think 41 actually did pretty well, and maybe even better than this season, is give a more like vivid character to some of those early boots, where I don't know if I could tell you much about, like, Maya, for example. And I mean, that is just one example. So maybe it's unfair to zoom in on that. But I think opinion has kind of turned a bit on 41. I know people who are just, like, swearing off that season entirely, and they're so glad that that dark age is over and we're now seeing the light of day again with 42. And I don't know. I think it was – I think there was a lot that was good there, and it was kind of throttled by a lot of the stuff imposed on it by production, and I'm just fearing that the same is going to happen here. And – we kind of managed to dodge that this time around, but let's not take that for granted.
Sure, yes. Always worth keeping in our back pockets there. Dom, I think let's get into the Hourglass 2.0 of it all, and then take a closer look at some of the more prominent players from this week kind of strategically, and what went on with how all of the strategizing and vote dynamics kind of played out there. Actually, let me begin by asking this question, and this is a true coin flip in my mind, and this is probably not the most meaningful part of the Hourglass twist to examine, but we do find out via Jeff talking just directly to the camera again, which was weird, but I guess it's just kind of a thing that is going to happen from time to time these days, and who cares that much. We find out that once again we're going to have two teams randomly drawn. The winners are going to get their merge buffs, they're going to get their merge feast, and then select someone to go off into isolation, where that person is pretty much invariably going to smash the hourglass and turn the whole game on its head here. But Dom, question number one from me, and again, I have no way which way to even be leaning here. Have you ever been to an Applebee's?
I don't know. That is my honest answer. I'm not hedging. I think in one of my many trips to the States that blur together, at some point, statistically, I must have gone to an Applebee's, just hungry, starving, delirious from the lack of nutrition. At some point, I must have crawled into an Applebee's, despite my better judgment, but could not tell you when or where.
Do they have the kind of Applebee's, Chili's, Outback Steakhouse sort of equivalent restaurants in England?
Not to anywhere near the same degree, as far as I can tell.
And I'm grossly self-conscious about asking this question. I assume they have them in Canada, right?
Probably, but again, I am not the natural patron of such establishments, and so I am not the one to ask. And that will not stop you from asking me anyway, but there we go.
Well, just to keep you posted, because I know you're a big French fry aficionado, any such establishments, generally speaking, have pretty legit French fries, so give them a shot whenever you're out and about in downtown Toronto again. But regardless, yes.
Well, I mean, clearly Applebee's marketing budget stretches deep if we're, you know, primetime national TV and also Survivor podcast here too.
Applebee's is no joke. This is a massive restaurant chain. But either way, the winning team is incidentally going to get some Applebee's for their so-called kind of merge feast here. But Dom, I don't think pretty much anyone is going to be too surprised by our just general hourglass and is this good or is this bad. Like, I, you know, we had that discussion last season, and I frankly don't think there's a big contingent, heard it both ways, of people online really defending the hourglass twist, although I may be dead wrong about that. I don't know. I don't spend a ton of time in the, like, Facebook casual kind of discussion groups where this sort of highly thoughtful discourse is generally playing out. I did want to say this, though. For whatever reason, it very much bothered me. I get why they did it, but to tweak it this season where Jeff makes it clear to the winning team up front that whoever you end up choosing, in this case between Lindsay or Roxroy, to go off into isolation is going to get some sort of big power. And if you're so inclined, you can give up your immunity that I've told you about multiple times. You just won the immunity challenge, as far as you know. You can give up your Applebee's feast after 12 or so days of starving out here with historically few food rations. And you yourself can go and be on exile and be the one who gets the power. To me, this is essentially like a complete joke of a way of kind of covering your ass as producers to make it seem less unfair than it very obviously is. Like to be able to fall back on the idea of, well, hey, any of the five of them could have given up their what they thought was going to be safety and their merge feast and gone off and taken the mystery box instead. To me, that is, I understand in general they are now making it a possibility to not get totally screwed over by this twist if you win the initial challenge here, but it is beyond laughable to me to, like, the idea that they thought anyone would even consider doing that is borderline ridiculous.
All I ask is that I don't want to audibly groan and feel the sense of dread whenever Jeff starts talking directly to the camera. Like that's I feel like that's a low bar. I want to be excited when Jeff is unveiling this new twist that he's so excited about. And in recent years, that has not been the case. So that's I want to be on the same page as Jeff. I am not currently. I would like to have a meeting of the minds there, so to speak.
We'll see what becomes of Jeff talking to camera. I think this was the first time we got it this season, although I'd be very surprised if this was the first time he was doing it on this season. I'm guessing they just decided not to air it whenever it was happening before. But one thing I think is really interesting about just kind of the state of Survivor going forward is, are we going to see something like this again? Because I do understand, to be generous to the producers, okay, we did this hourglass thing on 41. We haven't gotten to see any kind of reception to it other than, you know, what Danny and the others on that season thought of it, which isn't all too surprising or frankly unfair. And now we have this new group of people who have no idea what to expect, and this is the last time we're ever going to have that opportunity. I understand the impulse as producers to want to run it back and see if anything potentially goes down differently. We have a couple of tweaks that we're throwing in there, as comical as they may be, to make this less unfair, at least on paper, for the people who end up winning the initial challenge here. But now that we've done it on 41, now that we've done it on 42, and I'm sure there are dissenting opinions along the way, but I would imagine that overwhelmingly they have heard the feedback that this is not something that the average or median Survivor fan is necessarily that into. Are we going to see something like this again in the future, especially now that that door has been opened, where for anyone out there on a future season who has seen at least season 42, there could be reasons for someone to talk themselves into, I'll give up whatever looks like the absolute best case scenario for the mystery box. What kind of impact do you think this is going to have on the future of Survivor Twists?
I think it's going to cause there to be this doubt underlying any kind of new offer or new choice like that. And if I felt that the show was in more capable hands, that might be a good thing, where you can never take anything for granted and you want people to put themselves out there and to, you know, consider even the options that seem like they should be off the table. Given that it's Jeff at the helm of this, I don't know. I want to believe, but I really can't. And it's I see why, going back to, you know, our discussions before 41, when we had this hard reset on Survivor and we're trying a bunch of this new stuff and not all of this is going to carry across to 42 and future seasons, but some of it will, and we need to try this to see what sticks. My issue with that philosophy then, and my issue with it now, is that there is some stuff which I think you can just categorically dismiss outright when you look at it on paper as, this is a bad idea, and you don't need to try it and have it warp a season and see all the backlash towards that to know it's a bad idea. Like, you going through that is not a necessary part of the creative process, where we have a synthesis over here and antithesis over here, and eventually we work our way towards this more refined product. You don't need to do that. You can just cut the bad ideas, only have the good ones, and then move forward, as flippant as that sounds. And I worry that, if a twist is received well, great. That's validation for this impulse to try everything, however absurd it might seem. If it's not received well, hey, you feel strongly about it, so that's a good thing. That's a success in its own right. And hey, if we never try anything controversial, how do we know what you're going to like? You know, you should be mad about this sometimes. And there's no way in which you can ever reach a conclusion, oh, they just fucked up and made a mistake.
And especially when you look back on those 41 interviews with Jeff, when there was the initial kind of backlash to the Hourglass twist. I think that's what the context of this sort of sentiment was from, where when asked about it, like in interviews, Jeff would give the answer of like, oh, you know, people always complain about whatever new thing we're trying. And then over time, in a lot of cases, they end up loving it. And that is the kind of thing that leaves me a bit more nervous about the future of Survivor kind of game design than I would like to be, which is, I understand this show has been on for 20 years and they want to constantly be looking for new ways to make it fun and make it fresh. I do think the Hourglass was one of those that began with noble intentions, but probably should have been scrapped somewhere along the line before it was even tried out on 41, let alone tried again on 42. But in the best of circumstances, if I felt like better about the people making these sorts of decisions, it would be a lot easier for me to kind of look past this sort of thing. And in general, even with the exact people who are making these sorts of decisions, I do have some degree of faith in them to get rid of whatever they try that is aggressively terrible for the game. And we'll see what happens as far as Hourglasses and kind of things along these lines are concerned, like Jeff explicitly lying to the players, I'm hoping is something that is ultimately just going to be scrapped going forward, although they certainly deserve for at every immunity challenge from now for the next several seasons for some player in the cast to raise their hand and double check, hey Jeff, you're not going to reverse this result with some magic power from the sky, right? Like, they have brought that on themselves if that is what they get from the players on upcoming seasons, until they have proven that they can be trustworthy along those lines. But my greatest concern is that things like this, things like the fire challenge falling out of the sky and then finding a permanent place in the way that the game is now structured, is essentially the producers laying out the expectation for the players and the audience that essentially literally nothing is off the table, and whatever kind of wacky bullshit we want to pull, that's just how Survivor works now. I think that was kind of the undoing of US Big Brother. I think we're in the process of watching that be the undoing of Australian Survivor, when you just go so far off the deep end along those lines. And that would be my biggest concern, is that they are essentially trying so many things of not specifically Hourglasses or fire challenges or whatever twist advantage you want to talk about in specific terms. I think they're kind of laying the groundwork for, we can do whatever we want and we can never be held accountable for anything that doesn't work. That is the biggest concern for me, is kind of giving mm-hmm. themselves the free roll.
Yeah, okay, I was going to say something and then lost it there. Give me a second. Yeah, if there's anything that recent events have taught us, it's that what we need is Mike White chiming in to save Survivor once again. So apparently almost single-handedly responsible for fire tokens not being brought back for 41, and has been credited with killing some other twist in the past. So whoever Mike White's handler is needs to aggravate him again before 43 to make sure that we stay on the right course there.
I'm on board with that. So, all right, Dom, let's get into how all of this, I don't know what to call it other than a merge, although I'm willing to grant that this is technically not a merge for whatever reason, even though it's 12 people playing individually and virtually all of them are going to be voting at this tribal council. This merge in spirit round here, we're going to wind up with Jonathan, Marianne, Lydia, Tori, and High as our winners of this challenge in a landslide. And by the way, when they got to the puzzle and it seemed like they were kind of being potentially borderline combative with each other and talking about how much of a cushion they had in terms of, oh, there's no rush on the puzzle, just make sure you do it right. I started thinking to myself, oh my God, this team's going to blow it on the puzzle and unknowingly do themselves an enormous favor. But that ultimately does not come in here. And so those five are temporarily feeling extremely good. They're going to get the Applebee's feast here, and they're going to be deciding between Lindsay and Roxroy for who to ship off to Exile Island and who to bring with them for the safety and for the merge here. It's going to be Roxroy who is going to ultimately be our hourglass person of the season. And I promise I'm going to be done complaining about the hourglass momentarily. But one quote from Roxroy while he was out there, and I do think this is along the lines of how the producers see it, is when he was making that decision, he said, okay, well, if I smash the hourglass, six people get a do-over. And sometimes in life, everyone deserves a do-over, end quote. This is not a do-over. This is not a second chance. They're not going to replay the challenge and see if the other team can win, if they get to turn back time and take their own fate into their hands and whatever the producers would have you believe. This is just explicitly punishing people for succeeding in the challenge and rewarding people for failing in the challenge. And so that I felt like was kind of Roxroy serving as a mouthpiece for how the producers kind of justify this to themselves. But we've spent enough time.
I mean, nothing against Roxroy here. You put me in that situation, I know already I'm going to be a focal character in this episode. I am leaning into that as hard as possible. Give me that airtime. Just run it up. Let's go. And hey, if I get voted out in the next few episodes, which honestly is going to be a miracle that I've made it that far in the first place, I need as much airtime as I can get. So just pile it on me.
Right. The larger point here is I really just so wholeheartedly object to the, like, turning back time metaphor in the first place. We're not going backwards in time. We're just reversing the challenge result for essentially literally no reason here. I'm sure everyone hearing us has had plenty of hourglass discussion enter their ears already to this point this week, and is on at least roughly, not necessarily on the same page, but I'm guessing very few people are left out there as undecided voters on is the hourglass good or bad, and very little that we're going to say at this point is going to change their minds there. But yeah, Roxroy, of course, going to smash the hourglass, and now he, I wrote this down, let me go, okay, he, Mike, Chanel, Drea, Romeo, and Omer are going to be the ones who are safe, which I guess is news that is broken to them. What is it literally the day that they go and vote? Like they'll go and vote that night? Because Roxroy was gone for two full days and two nights, right? And so they spent plenty of time thinking that the other six were going to be the ones who were safe, right?
Yeah, piecing together the exact schedule here is pretty difficult. And then you add to that the additional layer of, I guess Omer knew that he wasn't going to have a vote, but you can imagine someone getting to the merge, being thrust into this inherently chaotic situation, and then getting this double whammy of thinking they're safe, but then not being safe, or vice versa, and then not knowing when making plans before getting to the vote if they themselves will be able to cast a vote or not, or how many votes they'll be able to cast. So it seemed like some of that was minimized. No one was fully in the dark, but many people acting with some degree of imperfect information.
How much did it seem like whatever big alliance was going to form ended up hinging on the fact that this result ended up getting switched over? Because frankly, even as a person who has rewatched this episode now, it seemed like whichever group of six was going to be safe versus vulnerable, roughly the same people were going to be dictating which direction the vote went, and it was just a matter of which of the targets was going to be available. Or did Lydia seem like she would have been in with the big group for the long haul in your eyes had she been able to just remain safe on this vote.
So when I saw how these two groups were being split up, my first thought was you kind of have an easy consensus pick on either team. So if Tori's team is vulnerable, it seems like you could get a consensus together against Tori or against Jonathan if you want to take a shot at the big challenge beast early. And then on the other team, everyone already is super suspicious of Chanel. So it seems like that could be an easy vote. And to some extent, it might be easier to get to rally against an easy vote when in that group only four or five different people are vulnerable. And so there's this incentive to just pile on the easy vote and at least get through this. And then once the game is opened up, everyone else is vulnerable too, then you can take the more ambitious move later on. As it turns out, that wasn't really what happened. So we had this really fascinating power struggle within that subgroup over who exactly was going to be safe. And it was, you had Omer, who didn't have his own vote, but was immune from the vote, facing up against Hai, who was kind of in the thick of things and also potentially could have been vulnerable himself if things went differently. And so seeing these people in this, seeing those two people in very unequal situations square off as equals was a really fun, moment to see happen.
Yeah, and I thought it was interesting that it seemed like the people who were essentially on the ins in whatever was remaining of their original tribe kind of came together. And I feel like that is a pretty rare circumstance, if not literally like unique circumstance for us here, Dom, where I would have thought that not necessarily two of the three teams gang up on the other one, but to see basically the majority alliance from within each of three separate tribes come together is maybe not literally unprecedented, but a very rare sort of occurrence, especially with this many people left, as we enter this merge-like experience here on day 13 that I thought was fascinating. And I don't know necessarily how long that big group is going to be able to keep themselves from getting greedy and taking some shots at some of the more influential people, maybe some of the people who have an advantage or two or three, as the case may be, in their back pockets here. But I do feel like it may be a pretty good indicator of just what a modern merge feels like, where, and I don't think this is anything new by any stretch. I think this has been the case for at least somewhere in the neighborhood of 5 to 10 years or so. But I feel like the merge might be, with the possible exception of like the literal first vote that your team ends up going to, the ultimate time, and maybe Lydia is like a counterexample of this and the way that the target ended up falling on her, but I would have thought, and it seems like people were in general willing to take the approach of, now that we're in this brand new situation with so many people that we've never met before, I'm fully satisfied with pretty much any name that is not me or like my tight number one. And I am not going to be judging anyone too harshly for feeling the same way.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to, well, it seemed like a lot of suspicion may have fallen on those in other circumstances who were very clearly just like, all right, I just want to be with wherever the numbers are going and get through this round. And people kind of read into that of, oh, well, if they just want to be where the numbers are going, then they're not going to be loyal to me later on down the line. In this particular context, I feel like that is becoming more and more acceptable of a kind of approach to take. And I think that's probably with very good reason here, especially given how much shit you can plan on, like absolutely count on in modern Survivor, falling out of the sky that you have no way of anticipating over the course of however many days are left at the point where you merge. But let's actually talk a little bit about Omer more specifically, because I think his spot in particular is a very interesting one, where once Roxroy gets back, Omer finds out, okay, he is now suddenly locked safe at this vote that he thought he was going to be vulnerable for, and has already done the math that he is not going to have a vote of his own because of Chanel's decision a few weeks ago when they were off on their journey together. My initial impulse, Dom, when we got the confessional from Omer about I'm lock safe and I don't have a vote, so I'm just going to keep my mouth shut, and we'll obviously go on to see him not stick to that plan necessarily, although it seems like maybe with good reason there. But the idea of being someone at a modern Survivor merge who everyone knows cannot be eliminated that night, and furthermore, essentially everyone knows they're not even going to have a vote of their own to cast that night. Am I crazy for feeling like that might be like the dream spot where you don't have to get any kind of real blood on your hands unless you want to, as we'll see Omer go out of his way to do in terms of like trying to dictate which direction the vote is going, where he doesn't have to put pen to parchment and he knows and other people know that he's going to have a lot more potential kind of flexibility than those who are going to have to go and cast votes that night. And furthermore, and I think this is kind of vital, it seems to me like if I were out there at a merge situation and I knew that someone else in the game was in the Omer spot of guaranteed safe, doesn't have a vote of their own, I would be leaning so heavily on the side of that is a person I very much feel incentivized to be honest with because they're going to have so much flexibility going forward and I don't want to blindside them with whatever direction this vote ends up going, or at least my vote ends up going.
I think we mentioned with Jeremy's, what was it, safety without power advantage back in Winners of War that sometimes you would want to leave tribal not because you feared for your own safety, but just to not be perceived, not to have to cast a vote and take a stance and draw a line in the sand, so to speak. And yeah, I mean, I think Omer is just kind of chilling here. And I wonder if, in a way, not having his own vote maybe is motivating him to pick this fight and to try and exert this influence over the outcome, just to feel like he did actually have an impact here, to have that sense of control. Whereas if he is in the ideal spot that everyone else is in of, hey, I'm safe, but I also get to vote, then that, what more do you need? It almost feels greedy at that point to do anything else.
At Omer's spot here is functionally very similar to a safety without power situation, except he still gets to watch all of it play out. He doesn't have to leave the tribal council in case things go haywire. So yeah, I loved just the theoretical spot that Omer was in here. Loved hearing him say, I'm just going to hang back and shut up. And then when he started really getting in the mix with trying to dictate how the vote might end up playing out, my initial reaction was, oh my God, what are you doing? Just let it play out however it's going to play out, and pick up the pieces from there. But it seemed like he felt heavily incentivized to try to swing the focus off of Jonathan or Marianne in particular and see what he could do about getting Lydia gone. And it seems like he did a very effective job, even though everyone he was talking to knew that he himself was going to have no actual say that night.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So a big week, I would say, for Omer here. And it certainly seems like he's someone to keep an eye on going forward. If this is how he's going to be approaching things when there's virtually less incentive than there's ever going to be in any kind of realistic timeline that he's going to find himself in the future to just go out of his way to stir the pot here. Very much looking forward to seeing what else Omer is going to be bringing to the table down the line here. Another person, Dom, that I thought really stood out this week, at least during the initial kind of like big group formations, someone, let me pull up this confessional chart because I would have said that this is someone we hadn't heard a ton from to this point, despite pretty consistently being on the inside of what was happening around her, is Drea, who is sitting here as a 16 confessional person, just for the record here, where before, I guess, they knew that the result was going to be overturned. It seemed like a lot of things were flowing through Drea and the connections that she had from the idol, and furthermore from the amulets, and just from being on the inside of that initial blue team in the first place. What do you think about Drea at this point?
I never know what to think about Drea. She feels like she keeps her cards pretty close to the vest, or the chest, heard it both ways. And we saw a lot of her just being in all of these different conversations with so many different people, and I think I trust her to kind of keep all of those balls in the air at the same time, especially when she has seen with first with Swathi and then kind of with Tori as well, how that can go wrong and how to like not make that mistake and to do it better. And with all of the various trinkets that she has, right, she has, well, what's the total now? She's got the amulet, she's got the...
She's got the amulet, the idol, and an extra vote.
So she's got all of that. And we saw some of her kind of selectively revealing different bits of that to different people to achieve specific goals and not just blurting it all out or kind of getting herself caught in different stories at once. So far, so good. But I'm kind of holding my breath for the like Shan-style downfall episode almost, where like people compare notes and everyone agrees, wow, okay, we have someone who everyone likes and trusts, it seems, and also just has the most ammunition of anyone in the game. Maybe worth a shot at taking that person out at some point. The only thing that really gave me pause was that like clash with Marianne at Tribal, where it felt very forced. It felt like Marianne was kept trying to de-escalate that, and Andrea was like, no, we're going to keep doing this in full view of everyone just to rub it in and drive the point home, which that just felt very strange to me.
It felt bad to me. Like, that's just not the reaction that I would consider an elite Survivor player giving, or even like having it cross their mind that is the way they should handle that situation with Marianne. But that's basically the first thing I feel like I've seen out of Drea that would give me much concern in the short term, and I'm not even sure how concerned I am in like the super immediate short term, but as you hit on, I do think Drea is doing a highly effective job, but I also think people may be not only likely to catch on to that in the future, but probably are already catching on to the position Drea has found herself in this game. And I think not only in that conversation with Marianne at Tribal, or non-conversation potentially with Marianne at Tribal Council, I think generally speaking, Drea gives off, at least based on what we've seen on TV, very kind of like business-like and transactional vibes when playing Survivor. And I doubt it is possible that someone could find themselves as influential and kind of at the center of things without being very good at having like the personal conversations and just the social game in general, whatever that means these days. And we may be seeing a very heavily edited version of Drea. At the same time, I did see a tweet pop up on Wednesday night from Drea that just said, "It's a TV game show, nothing personal." And I then hovered over to see Drea's kind of full Twitter profile, and to quickly read you here her bio: Survivor CBS 42, charitable boss babe giving online bodylicious classes while globetrotting. Shop my programs and equipment below. So I do wonder if Drea is perhaps a bit more business-minded than is necessarily optimal for Survivor.
I mean, I respect that more than the whole, you know, I'm a creature of God, and then the hard pivot into online shilling immediately after your season. I like that we're just open and brazen about it from the outset.
Yeah, and maybe the rest of the cast is looking at that and thinking, hey, this is exactly what I want in an ally who is maybe not going to be the most difficult person to beat in a jury vote. And if everything is being filtered through the lens of what's good for my game, that, to go back to like a classic Yul Kwan philosophy on Survivor, that makes them relatively predictable compared to like the Keith Nails of the world, who are liable to just do whatever on any given vote. Not to pick on specifically Keith, there are many, many people from the history
but
of Survivor.
Also a little bit to pick on Keith.
He's just generally the first one who comes to mind for me of like, I if I were a Survivor player, I would hate the idea of everything coming down to getting Keith on my side, whereas I would feel much more comfortable of everything coming down to getting a Drea, or in Yule's case, a Jonathan Penner on my side, who I can at least present some sort of argument to about what's in their best interest, and that feel good about that being like a relevant consideration for them. Mm-hmm. But in any event, I do feel like Drea is another one to certainly have an eye on here, for as long as she's out there.
Yeah.
Yeah. How about this, Dom? Another big power player, it feels like we saw emerge here, was Hai, who got the word that things after the big immunity reversal were not looking great for his tight number one ally, Lydia, who he was not eager to see leave anytime soon, and really wanted to do what he could to put his foot down to try to get some other result there. But ultimately, we will go on to see, cast his own vote for Lydia, which I thought was really interesting, especially because he got a confessional that I have written down. Okay, here we go. Where leading into that tribal council, we go to Hai, who says, quote, "Moments like these are where good players fold and great players prevail," end quote. And in my mind, I think that what he probably meant at the time that he was saying that is, what a good player would do is just kind of fold and go along with the big group, but the great players would prevail and save their ally, and he's ultimately not going to go that direction. But the way it came across on TV, I thought was really good and made him look impressive and worth rooting for here. So
there is also the unspoken part of, also, a bad player would overreach and fail to win that fight if they picked it, and then end up blowing up their own spot while losing their ally in the process. And sure, that maybe is what we saw play out here. I don't know. I have faith in my man Hai to rebound from this, and I don't know if you need to rebound if you kind of accept it. And just, we saw him vote for Lydia in a move that kind of stunned a lot of viewers, I think, and seemed very cold-blooded. But coming off the back of Hai's biggest unique selling point being, I go to the war for my people. You saw what I did to stick up for Lydia. And I think that's what kind of won Mike over to Hai, potentially. After all of that, to just be turning around and pushing her in front of the bus as soon as it comes along, I don't know if that damages that image too much.
So I had a couple, I'm of kind of two minds about this. One is, maybe, so first of all, I would say, as far as I can tell, if Hai thought there was any realistic chance of saving Lydia here, he probably would have tried to more strongly pursue that option. So when I see that Hai ultimately puts his own vote on Lydia, I am giving him enough credit as a player to be doing the math on, Hai probably thought that this was just a lost cause, and so he didn't want to just stand out from the pack. He wanted to establish himself as part of this big group that was coming together at what is certainly among the most important votes of the entire game here. And furthermore, there may be some kind of sneaky upside to losing Lydia that I don't think he would have voluntarily traded, but that may kind of play to his benefit going forward of, first and foremost, people no longer being worried about the threat of Hai and Lydia being like an unbreakable duo if one of them is gone, and, you know, other people that he would hope to have as allies perpetually having to say to themselves, well, he's always going to prioritize Lydia above me. He no longer has that with which to contend here. But
yeah, I think it might be that classic case of, he wouldn't really complain too much if Lydia left, but being complicit in her leaving in any way, or not being seen to fight for her hard enough, just erases any benefit that might give to him.
I was wondering about, along those lines, first of all, will fully grant that Hai has a much better idea of what the actual specific dynamics were like out there than I do.
Obviously.
Of course. But I was thinking, this feels like basically like a season one, like super old school kind of Survivor move from the very, very early years, that I honestly can't even remember if it ever paid off even for anyone to go this route. But I, even 20 years later, continue to believe that there is some sort of positive message to at least conceivably be sending. If you're in this high spot, you know Lydia is about to leave, or feel like that's overwhelmingly likely, and I'm not going to fault him whatsoever for putting his own vote on Lydia to, if he felt like that was the best decision for truly ingratiating himself in whatever big group was going to form, at least in the short term. That said, I have this weird impulse, and it's probably wrong, but I want to just put it out there. I feel like this could have at least been an okay spot, as long as the people who were in the majority that were voting for Lydia were aware of why he was doing this, to not vote for Lydia, like, make it clear he knows she's going and he's fine with that, but he gave her his word to never put her name down, so he's going to just throw his vote onto whoever. Marianne. Someone random who is not in jeopardy to... Marianne may be a bad example because her name was getting thrown out there, but point is, the deliberately voting for someone other than the person you know is going home to demonstrate just what a ride or die ally you are in a game like this, where in a situation like this, within a game like this, where everyone is so all over the place and plans are changing all the time. I did wonder if there was some sort of value in the deliberately throwing his vote so that people would know going forward that, hey, he'll go down with the ship. If he tells me he has my back, he 100% has my back. And actually, to now that I think about it, one example of this potentially working very well, Dom, not Survivor, how about Dan Giesling on BB10 knowingly voting to keep Brian in that first week, and people did genuinely say, oh, wow, Dan is a real ride or die, and that never backfired on anyone.
Yeah, not really getting any Dan vibes from High, but maybe I am just so thoroughly missive that I can't see the forest for the trees there.
Exactly, yeah, that's the ultimate Dan vibe, is not getting any Dan vibes because you're just so misted there. I am getting Dan vibes from High here of perpetually being one of the best social players in the cast, as far as I can tell, while also perpetually looking out for number one. And Dan Giesling is one of the greatest of all time at both of those things. So, you know, not to put too much pressure on High, but anything short of a Dan Giesling-esque performance will disappoint me. Dom, High, to just kind of wrap up on that, is someone I'm going to be very curious to see which direction he ends up wanting to go kind of long term here, because I would imagine he's not thrilled about the way that all of this played out, despite ultimately putting his vote in that direction there. Another person that kind of surprised me here in terms of their role within this merge vote, another one that I would say is playing a very strong social game based on what I've seen to this point, but that was actually left out, it seemed like, at least, of the way things were playing out here. A person this time last week I was saying was someone that might be my number one overall winner pick entering this merge, Romeo, shockingly to me, was not involved in, at least on paper, the way this majority vote went down. Are you surprised by that?
I confess I didn't follow up on like exactly who voted for who and who was on what side of that eventual breakdown. That does kind of surprise me. Especially with that scene that we saw of him really opening up too high, I figured that would translate into something in terms of alignment in the game, but maybe they were on the same side, but High eventually saw where things were going and just flopped his vote the other way to like be on the right side of things, and Romeo just like wasn't in on the loop there. I don't know.
It seemed like Romeo during the initial kind of big group getting together was involved. He had a great scene with High talking about just their experience as gay men that was great to see make air there. And it seemed like at a certain point, as each group was kind of throwing out the person from their original tribe that they would be okay with seeing leave, Marianne was a name that was coming up there alongside, of course, Tori and Chanel. And then something happened where it seemed like Romeo kind of got swapped out of that big group and Marianne got put in there in his place. Romeo, I'm looking at the voting chart now, ultimately did vote for Marianne. Maybe that was some sort of preventative measure for whatever reason, but my read at the moment is that Romeo was one of few people on the outside of the way this plan was ultimately going to come together, along with, if the votes are any indication, the people who did not vote for Lydia were Romeo, Roxroy, Tori, and Chanel. So I'm certainly not trying to say, oh man, it's game over now for Romeo, but being on the wrong side of the merge vote is historically not the place to be. So still remains a player that I believe in terms of what he brings to the table socially and strategically, but not the start at the merge that I was expecting or excited to see here from Romeo. Speaking of people who were just on the outs of this vote, the other two that I thought were potentially worth getting into and at least passing here are Tori, who is going to find herself immune here, first time for everything. And yes, shout out to everyone on Twitter for the Tori finally getting immunity jokes that were very strong there. I feel like Tori, probably not near the top of the list for like winner candidates or like power players anytime soon candidates, but I certainly have very high hopes for just Tori the TV character and game destroyer as things stand right now.
Yeah, Agent of Chaos, I think, is the perfect role for her to find herself in.
Yeah, and I think she's hopefully going to just embrace that. And then someone I feel like could be in a similar sort of spot, although I think I would have more faith in this person to potentially right the ship here, is Chanel, who, frankly, kind of surprised I was surprised by the extent to which it seemed like people were not interested in her being in on the plan, especially if we're going with the theory that, like, we just want to get numbers for whatever vote is going to get me through this round. As we enter a merge, as chaotic as this, there was that scene of Chanel walking up on the big group and them all immediately changing the subject and Lydia being very wishy-washy with her there. I don't know what is giving me this sense, but Chanel is standing out to me as someone who was on the wrong side of this vote but could recover from it. I feel like she still at least conceivably could bring enough to the table to be brought in for whenever this big group gets greedy and wants to start turning on each other. If Chanel is still there, I feel like they'll be more receptive to working with Chanel than a Tori or a Roxroy.
I think that she might be the wolf of the season now, and she's inherited that curse or that mantle from Daniel, and you know she'll bestow it to someone else when she gets voted out, and that will just be passed around like a hot potato until it eventually explodes.
I feel like it's a two-horse race at this point between Chanel and Tori for the Ace Gordon Memorial Wolf of the Season, but others could potentially get into that mix as well. I mean, High could certainly be classified as a wolf in some of these timelines here. Drea, I think, is in the mix there. Romeo, if he gets some revenge on people, I think TBD on which direction that timeless honor is ultimately going to fall there. But yeah, Chanel is another person that I feel like probably not near the top of my winner rankings as things stand now, but certainly plenty of upside to do some damage if she's left in the game for long enough. Dom, speaking of being left in the game for long enough, a question that I actually got earlier today from great friend of the podcast, official accountant of the podcast, AJ Van Gilder, hit me up asking, in theory, if I'm out there, how long am I willing to let Jonathan stick around here before I become very nervous about the prospect of him running the table? And I'd be curious to hear your answer before I give mine.
So I feel like it only becomes an important question at a certain point, and then you kind of immediately know how important it is, if that makes sense. So you think back to Joe in Cambodia, just rattling off those first four immunities, making it look easy, and then getting clipped almost as soon as he started losing. While Joe is winning and dominating, you you get scared of that, and you start to wonder, like, can this guy actually just run the table and render the entire game around him obsolete? But while he's winning, there's not really much you can do about it. And so at the first point at which Joe lost, well, now everyone really has to take stock and ask if you can afford to let him go any further. With Jonathan, like, he didn't win the first time around, and then if he just starts, I guess, not winning and continues being vulnerable and also is not seen as, like, a threat for other reasons, then, yeah, maybe you just let him coast by for a bit, and then at your convenience, when you get around to it, you can take a shot.
I'm willing in the super immediate term to give Jonathan a pass or two or three or somewhere in that neighborhood, but I think once we get down to 9, 8, 7 people, I'm going to start having some serious concerns about the prospect of Jonathan just kind of brute forcing his way there. And a big piece of that is, as we talked about in last week's podcast, it does seem like one of the very few reliable things in modern Survivor is the way the individual challenges are structured, where once we merge, there are going to be several in a row that are largely, as far as immunity is concerned, balance and endurance. And that is what we saw this week. I would expect that's what we're going to continue to see for the next 2-3 weeks, somewhere in that neighborhood. And then once we hit the kind of late mid game, early end game, it's going to transition back into being intensely physical stuff. Not necessarily intense, but that's going to be a much bigger factor. And I believe that plenty of the people in this cast are aware of that. I think this has been a running challenge format for many, many, many years at this point, potentially pretty close to the entire time that we have been in Fiji, which this is now, by the way, the 10th consecutive season in Fiji. I know I in my mind knew that we had been there for a while. I didn't realize we were now at double digit seasons in a row in this location there. So I'm willing to look the other way and use Jonathan as a shield another round or two, somewhat comfortably, maybe a little beyond that, but anything after like 9, 8, 7 in that neighborhood, I'm certainly going to be sweating the prospect of Jonathan running the table between challenges, idols, fire challenge, whatever else may fall from the sky here. And that will increasingly become a concern and eventually reach a tipping point for me, if I'm hypothetically out there, and I would imagine for most of the people who are indeed out there with Jonathan. And by the way, can you imagine what the aforementioned, like, Facebook casual chat reaction would be had this hourglass twist taken out Jonathan in a situation where he did indeed just crush yet another challenge and essentially get punished for it?
Oh, it would be unbearable. And you know that would be the perfect excuse for Jeff to break his mantra against bringing people back too soon. You know, you would see Jeff, or you would see Jonathan, rather, as a team captain on, you know, 43 mm-hmm. or 44 if he was willing to wait that far.
Yeah, and incidentally, I think in any situation where that was the result we got in this vote, even with every single thing being absolutely identical in terms of Jonathan's interactions with people and challenge performances up to that point, if this had gone against Jonathan because of the hourglass twist, the version of Jonathan that we would have seen on the TV episodes to this point, I think would have looked massively different. I think he would have gotten the future twist victim edit that we talked about last season with Sydney. And I think that potentially plays a role in why we saw less of Lydia than I would have liked to, just based on how fantastic she is on Twitter and whatever else, where I think they really could have shown, a much funnier for sure. And, more visible and more rootable kind of version of Lydia if they'd wanted to go that route, but they knew that this twist was going to ultimately be her undoing, and they didn't want that to be like devastating, I would imagine, to the average casual fan. And along those lines, if this were the way that Jonathan ended up being taken out of the game, I suspect he would have gotten like the full kind of like Chris Noble treatment along the way to make people happy about that result.
which should give you pause for thought if you are someone in production and clearly you want to give this guy the biggest edit you can. You're gushing over him. You get weak at the knees whenever he effortlessly dominates another challenge. If you then feel pressure to dial that back and to hide him or to bury him because we can't have the casuals in uproar because we screwed him over with a twist, then just don't screw him over with a twist. That feels like a very easy way to to get around that problem.
One would think, yeah. But we continue to get a lot of pretty compelling content, I would say, out of Jonathan when we do get to see him outside of like the challenges this week in particular. It seemed like he and Mike really developed a quick bond there. And incidentally, Dom, Mike, who I'm going to now scroll up here on this Survivor 42 Wikipedia page to make sure I don't get this number grossly wrong. I want to say Mike is 57 years old and like significantly older than virtually everyone else remaining in the game at this point. What an impressive job by Mike, right? To, it seems like, be hitting it off pretty well, at the very least, with virtually everyone with whom he has interacted at this point. And it seems like a very impressive run by Mike that, as far as I can tell, is showing no real signs of slowing down.
And I love that montage of Mike just really, I think sincerely, doing his best to just bond with as many different people as he could and try and find something to relate to in their experiences, you know, however difficult. And I mean, I think it's a smart thing to do, but also I think that's just the guy Mike is. So as an ally, I am fully supportive of Gays for Mike.
Absolutely.
Or
yes.
Whatever they're calling it these days.
Hashtag Gays for Mike is certainly taking over a decent chunk of my Twitter timeline on Wednesday nights, and with good reason there. I guess the only other I'm looking now down the cast list, and I feel like we've hit on virtually everyone. I guess we haven't said a ton about Lindsay at this point. You got any Lindsay takes this week, Dom?
I really don't. For someone who seems like pretty connected to what's going on and very sociable, good in challenges, really nothing bad to say about Lindsay, but also just in general, nothing to say about Lindsay, which I guess bodes well for the time being.
I mean, it's not a death knell by any stretch as far as I'm concerned, and actually, you know, immediately on the heels of Erica being one of the lower key people until she went and smashed the hourglass and then continuing to be low key for a while after that, an argument could be made that Lindsay may be in the best position in the entire cast here. I continue to really like everything we get to see out of Lindsay, and am anticipating that at least hoping if, and expecting that, we will get to see more from her. 'Cause it seems like, she's playing well and doesn't appear to be on too many people's radars at this point. So, hoping that we get a lot more Lindsay down the line here. And we talked about Roxroy off on Exile Island, smashing the hourglass, already kind of being his own little mini agent of chaos, albeit because of some egregious game design there. What's the over under on how long Roxroy stays in the game? 'Cause it seems like, socially and strategically, maybe leaving a bit to be desired here, but are people gunning for Roxroy anytime soon?
There's got to be bigger fish to fry, right?
I would think so. And then that really excites me, frankly, the idea of Roxroy just remaining in the game, almost not as an impartial observer by any stretch, but as someone that I would based on what we've seen to this point, I would be surprised if Roxroy is like calling the shots anytime soon. But I do like having him in there. It feels so demeaning to call him like a non-player character, but, cause he's certainly giving effort and will be casting votes far more often than not, I would imagine. But to have this guy who it seemed like appreciated his time away from everyone, including his wife, more than he enjoys actually playing the game, I feel like that does bring a fun dynamic to the season.
I would say the wife comment shows a lack of long-term thinking, should we to put it mildly, where like you have to know if you are watching the show at home at some point, you know, 8 months down the line, that you will be in the doghouse because of, and they will use that comment if they want to, and you are giving them license to do that. So just setting yourself up for failure there. Hopefully his in-game thinking shows a little bit more awareness, I guess.
I would sign up for Paramount Plus if they were telling me that some of the bonus content they were providing was the real-time footage of Roxroy's wife watching this episode back with him there. But yeah, I feel like he could be a very fun person to have, and maybe a vote or two will come down to which way Roxroy ultimately ends up wanting to go. But we'll see what ultimately becomes of that. So, all right, I guess just super parting thoughts from me. I know we've talked about Lydia to some extent already here, but I definitely feel like an apology is in order after the jinx that I put on her last week, talking about how she would be my number one pick in a last longer draft and the most likely person to make it deep in the game, and one of the people I was most looking forward to seeing a lot more from down the line here. That yeah, one's thanks, my bad, Colin. Guys. Yeah, sorry about that.
Typical.
Yeah, but Lydia, ton of fun. Based on what we got to see from her on this season, I'm assuming will continue to be a ton of fun for me on my Twitter timeline. Dom, any other thoughts from you on Lydia and her time in the game ending?
Fantastic style. Love that. What would you call it? Like a floral garb or something? Just for whatever reason, eye-catching, even on a season that includes such delights as the emu shirt, among other things.
Absolutely, yeah. So, anything else? What are we looking at? Who, gun to your head, who is your pick to be eliminated next week?
Next week, where I assume there's no twist, like scrambling what should be, just a normal round of Survivor.
Is Tori just public enemy number one? If she doesn't win,
I was gonna say like Tori or Chanel or someone kind of in that group of outcasts. Yeah, give me Tori. Why not?
Yeah, I think we could get one more week of the big group deciding to stick together and not get greedy just yet. Tori and Chanel along those lines probably stand out as reasonable enough kind of boot predictions. If we do see someone from the people who voted together in this most recent episode, this is at this point probably a chalk pick here, but I'm never going to be surprised if we show up and this is the week that people decide they need to get rid of Jonathan.
Yes. I could also see for either Tori or Chanel, this being like a version of the RC or Eliza merge boots where everyone just, they have their own grudges, and you'll see those rupture before too long. But for now, we can all come together around getting rid of this one person who no one trusts, no one really likes. Just get them out of there and then move on with business. And this merge twist may have delayed that, and possibly for good. But I could see that being how the merge would have gone, and now might go anyway, now that there's no twist, now that Tori, unless she wins immunity again, which that would be kind of fun if everyone is just champing at the bit to get Tori out, but she just keeps going on this immunity run. But if that doesn't happen, then yeah, I could see that being a fairly easy round off before the real fun begins.
So Tori in the mix for the Ace Gordon Memorial Wolf of the season. It sounds like Dom also in the yes. mix for the Alina Memorial Dirt Squirrel of the season.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah. And I guess since we did such a fantastic job last week jinxing Lydia, let's put on the record, Dom, who is your number one pick who is definitely not leaving next week?
Definitely not leaving next week. Am I meant to be using my powers for good or for evil here?
I think I was probably largely the one responsible for jinxing Lydia last week, so we'll see if you have that sort of capability in you to pull off the same maneuver here. And incidentally, just as a refresher for both you and the audience, when we did, God, I don't remember when it was. It might have been in our season 41 wrap-up, like season review podcast, when all we knew about the season 42 cast was their name, their age, location, and a picture, like a headshot of them, because we had had success with that method months before 41 began airing, when I picked Erica as my, like, essentially sight unseen winner pick, just based only on that super basic criteria, and you picked Xander, and they both ended up going super deep. A reminder to you, Dom, our two horses in the race along those lines this season, I have Drea, and you have Hi. I feel like we could potentially be doing a very solid follow-up here, and really cementing ourselves as people who should just stick to making calls based on nothing and just get further and further away from the point the more we see of everyone in the cast, as I give you some time here to pick who is definitely not leaving. But Drea and Hi both still in the mix, and I feel like both have plenty reasonable chance of going deep here this season, if not winning. So to kind of snipe potentially your person, I think I have landed on my name for who is definitely not leaving this week.
Okay, so should I go first then?
Go for it, and then I'm gonna prepare a backup one in case you snipe me here.
Okay, it gives me great pleasure to bestow official safety upon Marianne, question mark?
Okay, I think that is a reasonable enough pick at this point. And I'm sorry to do it to my Twitter timeline, if I do indeed have the jinxing powers that it seemed like I do based on this Lydia round, I'm going to say Mike is definitely not leaving this week.
Okay, well, the Twitter gays are going to come for you, and that will be a joy to watch. So hopefully we get it will be a shame to lose Mike, but the aftermath will be well worth it.
Okay, we will see how all of that goes. Dom, anything else from you this week?
No, I'm good.
All right. He is, of course, on Twitter at DomHRV. I'm on Twitter at Colin Stone. Bonus episodes going on over on the Patreon feed at patreon.com/DomandColin. Talking through Gabon. Just got to the Gabon fakeout merge. So a nice little tie-in here to season 42. And are going to be, I think, going double time on those now as we start losing the rest of the people in the Coda tribe. Spoiler alert. So that, I think, is going to finally do it for us here. Thank you, everyone who has made it this far. We will talk to you very soon. Take care, everybody.